had been observing in Europe an anti-abortion initiative in Portugal, another one in Finland. There's an anti-LGBT initiative in Croatia, another one in Romania. These were not all separate initiatives. These were all interconnected. And the connection was a secretive network that met behind closed doors.
Hi, this is Karin Weiss, and welcome to the Medicus Mundi Switzerland Health for All podcast. And today we talk with Neil Data, Executive Director and the founder of the European Parliamentary Forum for Sexual and Reproductive Rights. The European Parliamentary Forum is a network of members of parliaments from across Europe who are committed to protecting the sexual and reproductive health of the world's most vulnerable people. Hi, Neil. I'm so excited to have you as my guest on this podcast, Health for All.
Delighted to be here with you, Karin.
Anti-gender movements across Europe is increasing. They pursue insidious strategies aimed at undoing gender gains that have been achieved through history. Why is the idea of gender provoking backlash the world over?
That's a very interesting question. I think we need to unpack a little bit some of the understanding behind your question, and I would like to offer the following understanding of it. First of all, there has always been conservative resistance to social progress, and especially to areas related to women's rights and women's emancipation, and also anything related to sexual norms, in part because these are regulated by different religious and societal traditions. And this is a long way of saying that there has always been social conservatism, and it exists in every single society and country around the world. Whether you're in conservative Poland, for example, or groovy progressive Sweden or Netherlands, there's still some social conservatism everywhere. What's been happening specifically in Europe, but also in other parts of the world as of recently, is that there's a new game in town, and that now there is the emergence of anti-gender actors. And so these are a new category of actors, usually NGOs, but also think tanks and political parties, who are unhappy with the direction that certain human rights and societal innovations have taken. And what's interesting here is that they have decided to organize. And so the organization takes three main forms. One of them is professionalization. So now, instead of being amateur outfits where they protest in front of an abortion clinic and don't do much else, now they know how politics works. So they're able to go into a parliament, propose amendments, propose draft legislation. They go to court. They know how to run a court case. They have that level of professional competence. A second component is that they are transnationally connected, so that all of the different actors, which exist in all the different countries, now they meet, they exchange information, they strategize, so that your people in Switzerland, they will go to different meetings and they will exchange with colleagues from Germany, from France, from Italy, from the US and Canada, elsewhere. And they will see what happens in other countries. And they may think, that's a good idea. I can take this, adapt it this way, that way, and I can try it in my own country because the political climate is such and such at this moment. So I can try to do something on abortion, women's rights, or violence, or LGBT rights. And then thirdly, they have developed the capacity to renew their generations, okay? So that when I started working in this area, maybe 20 years ago, I took a look at these socially conservative NGOs, mainly what are called the pro-life movements, the anti-abortion movements. And what I saw 20 years ago was that they were small, amateurish, very locally concentrated, but very importantly, they were mainly headed by elderly men. And I thought, Okay, well, the problem will resolve itself. We just need to be patient, and then this generation will move on, and then that's the end of the problem. I was very mistaken in that analysis. Now these anti-gender movements have been able to create academies, capacity building sessions. Some of them have universities, so that now they have a whole new generation of people who are in their 30s and 40s. They have good diplomas in law, politics, human rights, different disciplines, and now they are taking up the fight in a new way. So I think all of this says that we're dealing with a new phenomenon here, professional, transnationally connected, and younger generation compared to what we had before.
You mentioned Poland before, because during my research for this podcast, I read throughout Eastern Europe, genderism is linked to communism or to totalitarianism. In Poland, more than 100 regions have declared themselves anti-LGBT zones, criminalizing an open public life for anyone perceived as belonging to these categories. Who stands behind these movements?
The question of the LGBT free zones in Poland is interesting. One is that we have to understand it that the origins of these are a document called the Municipal Charter, which tries to prevent what is called gender ideology from being propagated in a certain geographic region at the level of municipality. So these are municipal charters. And we can take a look at this from several ways. One of them is who wrote this charter? This charter was written by a group of lawyers associated with a far-right anti-gender organization, and these lawyers benefited from the support of this organization in defending them, these charters before the courts. This organization is called Ordo Iuris. So these charters are not grassroots movements that come from different localities, cantons, or cities, or things like this. They were a strategic tool devised by a group of ultra-conservative far-right lawyers and then offered to different municipalities as a way of preserving traditional family values. And then it turns out that the details of the wording would prohibit certain types of human rights, which are form of expressions of intimacy and emotions between same-sex couples of the same sex. A number of different municipalities adopted these laws, but then they came under a great deal of scrutiny. And so that whereas a number, maybe 3 years ago, it was over 100 municipalities that had signed up to these charters, including which covered a geographic space of about a third of all of Poland. So a third of all of Poland, maybe just geographically, that's all of the Benelux probably plus Switzerland together. So it's a huge geographic space. But since then, the EU has said that if these municipalities maintain these LGBT-free zones in these charters, they will not be eligible for EU funding. And this proved to be a very strong incitement for the municipalities to then reject these anti-LGBT charters. And as far as I know, many of them have since rejected them once they came under scrutiny, once they realized that this was very damaging to a whole part of their own citizen, and then once they also realized that they could risk losing a lot of money for doing something which is really, at the end, very hateful towards a certain member of their own community.
You mentioned in the first question that these movements are well organized, that they have a certain structure, and I was wondering who finances them?
So the question of financing is very interesting. We did a study of that and released it in June of 2021. The study is in a report called Tip of the Iceberg. When we took a look at the funding behind this, what we did is we identified all the anti-gender organizations, and then we simply tracked down what we could in terms of financial information. So we started out with a pool of organizations, over 120 of them. We were only able to get information for 54 of them. But already that information for 54 organizations tells us something. So we covered the period 2009 to 18. So during that period, 2009 to 2018, we know one thing: there is at least $700 million that went into this anti-gender movement in all of Europe, the geographic Europe, including Russia, etc. Secondly, the amount of money between the start and the end of that decade quadrupled. We started out with an annual spending of less than $20 million. We end up with almost $80 million a year in 2018. And I'm in the process of updating that number at the moment. It looks like since 2018, that number has even increased further. Third point is that there are three main geographic sources. One of them is the US, mainly the US Christian right, who are spending money in Europe, and that accounts for $80 million. Next source is the Russian Federation, mainly two oligarchs. They were funding far-right political parties and also different methods of socializing Western economic and social elites into being eventually pro-Russian in a very conservative agenda. The Russian accounted for $188 million. But since the aggression in Ukraine, that money has disappeared. If there's any money coming from Russia, and there probably is, it's very, very, very dark money at this stage, given the sanctions that are imposed by the West. And then the third amount is what should concern all of us, is Europe itself, all geographic Europe. So that accounted for $430 million of the $700 million. So the anti-gender movement in Europe is largely European funded. We can't blame the Americans or the Russians on it. They play a role, but it's our problem. And this money came from, in some cases, public sources. So illiberal governments or regional authorities. They came from our own wealthy people, social economic elites. They came from different ways of fundraising by the anti-gender organizations, such as through small amount donations and through different religious networks. So when we see the leadership of anti-gender organizations, we see that a number of the same individuals are leaders or play a leadership role in religious organizations and communities and networks.
In 2022, you won the prestigious Don and Aaron Fraser Human Rights Award. In your speech, you talked about when one stands up for human rights, they are increasingly confronted with lawsuits. You even call them strategic lawsuits against public participation. And this has developed into a whole industry of anti-human rights, anti-gender organizations to silence their opponents and cynically to mobilize resources. Can you give us an example?
Thank you for raising this. So what we're talking about is called SLAP, so strategic litigation against public participation. These are lawsuits used by certain actors in order to silence their opponents. They've been used in other sectors. For example, in the field of climate change, they were used by big companies, for example, in the petrol industry, to silence climate change or environmental activists. Okay. And the idea is, you know, the idea behind those is to, on the one hand, intimidate opponents, because even if you know this intellectually, when you get a lawsuit, it has an impact on you. Secondly, it's meant to drain the opponents of their financial resources and of their time, because then they have to spend time getting a lawyer, going to court, etc. So some very concrete examples of this. I myself am the subject of two SLAPP suits, one of them for the Tip of the Iceberg report, where I reveal the financing flows behind these organizations, and another one for testimony I provided in the European Parliament on who and what is behind the abortion ban in Poland. And that's when I testified before the European Parliament in a special hearing, and I explained that what's behind the abortion ban in Poland is this organization Ordo Iuris, who is also involved in the LGBT free zones, the criminalization of comprehensive sexuality education, and the initiative to withdraw Poland from the Istanbul Convention on Violence Against Women. So that's an example of my lawsuits.
Are you in danger?
It does have an impact psychologically. It does take time. It does cost financially. I'm not too worried about the one related to Tip of the Iceberg, because that will take place in a Belgian court. The one taking place in Poland with Ordo Iuris is in Poland. Poland right now is being criticized by the European Union for non-adherence to rule of law. So I'm more concerned about this depending which judge I fall upon. But maybe just as an anecdote to show how prevalent this is, Polish courts outlawed abortion in October 2020. In October 2021, my organization organized a meeting in Poland to show solidarity with our Polish colleagues in relation to access to abortion. So we were all gathered in Warsaw. The night before our conference, my team, together with the Polish organizers, various women's groups and pro-abortion groups and progressive groups in Poland, we decide to go for a dinner in a Georgian restaurant, a very informal affair. There's maybe 30 of us at this Georgian restaurant. And without making any effort, without thinking this through, we realize that among the 30 of us, there are at least five of us at that same table who are all being sued by Ordo Iuris for various forms of activism that we had taken on abortion or LGBT or human rights. So this is the extent to which this one organization is using slap suits. The head of the Polish women's strike, Marta Lempart, if you've ever seen scenes of Poland and the women's marches, Marta Lempart is the main figure who has organized this. She herself personally is facing over 100 slap suits, lawsuits. And so when you reach that number, you can see this is no longer just about ensuring justice. This is a tool to intimidate and silence and exhaust your opponents.
And I think this is a great force behind it. And I am sure many are intimidated by this movement.
We heard in Poland of just some local, normal people living in small towns in Poland who are part of the LGBT community who sent out a tweet, okay, just a tweet on something. They became the subject of a lawsuit by Ordo Iuris because of that tweet. Now, if you're just a local, normal person and you're being sued by one of the biggest organizations in Poland for a tweet, you have no one behind you. You don't have an organization. You may not have money to pay for a lawyer. And like many people, until you're sued, you don't know how to deal with a lawsuit. You know, it's something you have to learn when it happens to you. So it's very nerve-wracking.
And how come they have so much money to sue all these people?
Well, it looks like the lawsuit, at least with this one organization in Poland, is part of what our American friends would call a grift. It's a scam. The lawsuit against me being initiated in Poland, I learned about this because it was announced on Twitter. So I didn't learn about it through lawyers or anything like this. It was announced on Twitter. Then there were Twitter email blasts from this organization fundraising in Poland to sue Neil Data, this horrible guy in Brussels. And they revealed personal information about me and things like this. And then they sent several of these email blasts and Twitter campaigns to fundraise. Then the lawsuit is launched. The organization has fundraised. They hire lawyers. And it so happens that the people in the law firm that they hire are also associated with the organization that's suing me. So then the money that's collected is then assembled and then given to, it's taken in one pocket and then given to another pocket of the same people. And then like this, the lawsuit happens. Whether the lawsuit is successful for them or not, whether they win or not, it doesn't matter. They've been able to do communications, fundraise, and enrich themselves personally. And then by the time the lawsuit takes place, no one cares anymore. They announced the lawsuit against me in 2021. I had a first hearing in February of this year in 2023, and I have another hearing next year in 2024. By then, everyone will have forgotten about the initial thing, but they've been able to fundraise off of it in the meantime.
Hearing these stories and knowing how important it is to defend and improve sexual and reproductive rights, what needs to be done to counteract these movements?
In order to structure our thoughts how to counter them, I've tried to organize it into five areas. Each one starts with a D. So one is that we need to invest more intellectual effort and funding also into discovering in order to disrobe the anti-gender actors. We know that they do not like the light of day. And the more we research them, the more we find out about them, they're not the nice, cuddly Christians that they want to pretend to be. They're usually linked to dark forces, far-right political parties, hate groups in the United States, or Russian oligarchs somewhere else. By researching them, we will know how they function, we will know how they work. This then allows us to disarm them, because once we know what their tools and strategies are, it allows us to be better prepared for them. A third one is to dislocate them from positions of power. One thing that they're all aspiring to is to get into positions of influence. And so if we are able to recognize them and their tools, their strategies, we can then explain this to other decision makers to make sure they don't have access to political spaces. So discover, disarm, dislocate. Then I would say another one is to demonetize them. We have an idea of where the money is coming from. In some cases, it comes from public sources. So why should taxpayers' money go to undermine human rights for different communities? We can demonetize them. We can also organize accountability campaigns for the big companies and individuals, the wealthy individuals that are financially supporting them. And then finally, I would say what we need to do is really invest into a program of defending our human rights. We often think that abortion is a human right. We are happy with the human rights progress for the LGBT community or in the area of gender-based violence. But when we take a look at this, the legal foundations for these social progresses and human rights are more fragile than we anticipate. And so now that we know that they will be contested, maybe we should think about making sure that they're really well protected in our legal frameworks. One example of a very good initiative that I think is happening is what's happening in France, where they're actually thinking about putting the right to abortion in the Constitution. And I think this is something we should really think about in different countries, whether it's appropriate in different legal frameworks. But in many countries, the right to abortion is not that well guaranteed. Very often, it's simply taken out of the criminal code, and a woman can have the right to abortion only if performed in certain ways. And if not, then it is still criminalized. So is that really the woman's right that we thought it was?
If you had one wish to make this world a better place, what would it be?
That's a nice question. I would like to invite everyone to show compassion and understanding for everybody else. I think if we were able to do this, then through compassion and understanding, we would be able to be more generous and make sure that everyone is able to live the life that they would like to, according to their own destiny.
Thank you so much, Neil, for being my guest on the Medicus Mundi Switzerland podcast, Health for All.
Been a pleasure, Karim.
This was the Medicus Mundi Switzerland Health for All podcast with Karin Weiss. You can listen to it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify and on our website. To spread the message, please leave a comment on our website, share and like it. This was the first episode of the new season on the fight against the growing movement of anti-choice, anti-SRHR and anti-gender movements. Stay tuned and watch out for the next episode.